talking about what we began by talking about last week. And again, my main impetus for our learning tonight is to try and approach the story of Avraham from a pshat level, focused on the specific words the Torah used, because this is something that I don't think we appreciate enough. The way the Torah kind of tells us the narrative, the word choice, the scene setting, all these sorts of things actually provide us with a really, really rich story that helps us understand often a very different kind of Avraham to the Avraham we commonly think of. And that's not to say one Avraham is worse than the other, but we are so caught up, so consumed by the Avraham of the Parashiyot, who's this just kind of like, you know, very black and white, you know, holy man, you know, the first Jew of all these Midrashim and all these other things. And that's important, and we should focus on that Avraham. But there's another side to Avraham. There's another lens through which we can view the story of Avraham, which is as someone who is desperate and frustrated in his attempts to find a successor. And we spoke about this last week. Just to recap what we spoke about last week, we paid careful attention to the way the story introduces us to Avraham, obviously calling attention to two crucial points: the fact that his wife is barren, she's unable to have a child. And second, that Lot, his nephew, is effectively his son. And that's a very important point, and we're gonna realize this again today. We're gonna see this more. That's gonna be a crucial point to everything we talk about today too. Lot has to be seen as Avraham's next of kin. Terach adopts him, and then he goes with Avraham. And what I spent a lot of time trying to establish last week was who Avraham exactly is and his relationship with HaKadosh Baruch Hu. So first, Avraham is best understood as a tribal chief. Again, we talked about that at length last week. If anyone was unable to, you know, didn't listen yet, it's on YU Torah. We sent out a link. Just trust me on this one and listen to that one for more of the details. Don't picture Avraham as some kind of lone, random guy. Think of a man of means with a large, you know, following. He's a tribal chief. These are the, you know, the nefashot, the people made in Haran. These are the people made in that place. And in general, the way Avraham is often described fits that bill very much. And so a tribal chief, the key question such a person faces is who's going to succeed him as the leader. So that was the first thing we talked about last week, kind of establishing who Avraham is, trying to reframe our image of what we think of when we think of Avraham. The second is Avraham's relationship with God. Far from being this kind of instant, communicative, best friends forever kind of relationship, Avraham's actually very frustrated by God. We looked last week at the opening to Parashat Lech Lecha, the opening to the Avraham story, where God doesn't really talk to Avraham much. He doesn't really seem to say much, communicate. After Avraham arrives in the land of Canaan, God doesn't really say much, despite Avraham's best efforts to contact him. And Avraham ends up wandering all the way down to Egypt. Essentially, he takes the initiative. He sees there's famine. He takes the initiative. He goes down to Egypt. He takes the initiative. He passes Sarah, his wife, off as his sister in order to save everyone, to keep everyone alive. And that's when God kind of steps in. And this is an important pattern to bear in mind also for tonight. Whenever Avraham seizes the initiative, doing what, you know, maybe any sensible person might do, whenever Avraham seizes that initiative, God often thwarts it, and that's obviously frustrating for Avraham. With that kind of hasty recap of what we spoke about last week, let's share the screen. Let's make sure I share the room. Oh, here we go. Okay. Does everyone see the source sheet? Andy gives me a thumbs up. That means if Andy sees it, everyone sees it. Okay, great. So I want to begin by reading the story. So this happens, we actually looked at this last week also slightly. This is the story post-Egypt. So this is chapter 13, Parigud Gimel of Sefer Bereshit. We're still in, last week it was beautiful, it was timed perfectly with the parasha. Now we're lagging behind, we're still in Parashat Lech Lecha. Next week, we'll still also do Lech Lecha and Vayera combined as we read Chayesara. That's how we roll here. We were contemporary for a week. But we read the following. Begins source number one. Vaya'al Avram mimitzrayim hu ve'ishto v'chol asher lo. Avraham went up from Egypt together with his wife, with everything he had. Ve'lot imo hanegba. And Lot was also with him, heading up from the Negev. We learn then the Avraham kaved ba'od ba'mikneba kesef uva'zahav. Avraham's very rich at this point. I put ellipses because the next three psukim were crucial for what we talked about last week, less crucial for this week. And then we read, v'gam l'lot. Haholech et Avraham, Lot went with Avraham, hayatzon uvaka v'ohalim. And Lot, we learn, is kind of has his own wealth at this point. It's not just Avraham who's been made rich by the traveling down to Egypt. It's not just Avraham who has the fortune of this of his tribe. Lot also has it. And the key word here is ohalim. Lot has tents. The Torah is not telling us here that Lot's kind of the founder of REI, the camping goods store. It's telling us something far more significant. Tents mean, for a semi-nomadic tribal chief like Avraham, tents mean people. People loyal to Lot and not Avraham. Avraham has people within his tribe who are loyal to him, but that there are also people within this tribe who for one reason or another, we can only speculate, but speculate we will do shortly, people who are loyal to Lot instead. And we read, below, Nasa otam ha'aretz la'shevet yachdav, this is verse 6, and the land could not support them, ki haya ruchu shavram, because they have too many possessions, v'lo yachlu la'shevet yachdav, and they can't remain together. This is one of these verses that every commentator has a field day trying to explain, because the truth is, It's hard to imagine we're actually talking about geographical space here. Yes, we do read, I mentioned it last week, the very controversial words, v'haknani v'hakrizi az yoshev ba'aretz. Other people are in the land. This, which I just highlighted, might be important because it's not just Avraham and Lot trying to live off this, you know, small space, this small patch of land, but also the Kna'anim and the Perizim. Maybe the Torah literally means there's not enough space and everyone's getting in each other's way. But we also read, v'lo yachlu, lash, that highlighter went bad, v'lo yachlu lashevet yachdav. They can't dwell together. They can't remain in unison. And this is a very different kind of criticism. It's not the physical space as much as their inability to get along, their inability to work together, their inability to be one with another. It's not necessarily geographical space that's the problem, but I don't want to get too 21st century and say emotional space, but they're getting in each other's way. It's not necessarily that you're on this hill and I'm on that hill. It's not necessarily, sorry, that there's only one hill and we both can't fit on the same hill. It's you're on that hill, you're on this hill, but still that bothers me for some reason or another. And then we read verse 7. Vayhi riv. There was a riv. There's a reason I made it red. We'll come back to it in a second. Bein ro'e mikne Avraham, between the shepherds of Avraham, uvein ro'e mikne Lot, and between the shepherds, the herdsmen, the followers, the people of Lot. There is a riv. Riv is one of the hardest words to translate. Because it all revolves around the same rough idea, but there's tremendous subtleties. So the translation I pulled from JPS is quarreling. It can mean a fight. It can mean strife. But riv can also mean, and probably more correctly, actually implies legal dispute. Actually implies not physical battling, but kind of, you know, political, legal battling, a war of words rather than a war of physical. So a riv, you know, battle to confirm a Supreme Court nomination, we use it even in English, we use the term battle. You can have a battle between two, you know, people at war, and you can also have a battle to confirm a Supreme Court nomination. One is a legal battle, one is a physical battle. Riv is the same. It can mean multiple different things. It has many different connotations. This is probably why Chazal, Rashi quotes this very famous idea that that they're accusing the Roe Mikne Avraham are upset because the Roe Mikne Lot are stealing. And they don't have muzzles on the sheep, on the herd, and so they're eating the grass. There's some sort of theft going on. There's some sort of legal complaint. That actually is, you know, Midrashim can sometimes seem fanciful, but it's maybe more anchored in a good read of the word Riv than we realize. But there's some sort of, it's a not physical battle. They're not brawling. It's not, there's so little space that they are physically kind of, you know, battling one another to, you know, to gain a few meters here or there. It's, they can't get on together, and there is a riv. There is some sort of legal, some sort of political, some sort of tension of words, of emotions between these two. What possibly could it be? What is it? So, as I mentioned, I drew your attention to the fact verse 5 already tells us Lot has his own followers. Those are his ohalim. I'd argue, and this is pure speculation, but what else can I do except speculate? The followers of Lot. Lot has, as the Torah just stressed in verse 1 and verse 5, again, Lot's been following Avraham pottering around the desert. Lot endangered his own life going down to Egypt. Lot's been kind of wandering around. They've been following Avraham, going everywhere, uncertain of what's happening. And you can imagine that within the followers of Avraham slash Lot, within the tribe, there is tension. Some people maybe just want to settle down. Some people don't want to kind of, you know, continue this wandering, continue this aimlessness, waiting for a God that's not spoken to any of the rest of them. And this is something that I don't really want to talk about this too much, but it's something I think is important to remember. I mentioned last week kind of the problem of the omniscient or omniscient reader. We know the story. We believe in God. We're reading the Torah knowing God exists, knowing God spoke to Avraham. But if you're Lot and his followers, Avraham's just claiming to have heard kind of, you know, a deity speak to him. We know that deity to be HaKadosh Baruch Hu, but like it probably wasn't that unusual in the ancient Near East for tribal leaders to believe a deity was talking to them. And not all deities are created equal. So, you know, from Lot's followers' perspectives, Avraham might not be following, you know, the Lord of all, but might be following some kind of local desert deity. And, you know, who wants to follow that guy? So there's this tension. There's this battle between the followers of Lot and the followers of Avraham. And thus we read, Vayomer Avraham el Lot. Avraham turns to Lot, verse 8. Al natahi meriva beini uveinecha. Let's not have this, you know, strife between us. Uvein ro'ai, uvein ro'echa. And between your shepherds and mine. Ki anashim achim anachnu. Because we're brothers. What's really interesting is Avraham extrapolates and realizes, even though the Torah has taken pains to stress, Avraham and Lot are cool. Avraham realizes this has ramifications for his and Lot's relationship. Because you can imagine, if your followers are fighting his followers, it creates tension between the two people themselves. And interesting is the word Avraham uses, ki anashim achim anachnu. He recognizes a certain equality between him and Lot. He doesn't say, you're my nephew, you're my son. He uses the term achim. Again, the translation says kinsmen, but brothers in the sense of, you know, that there is an equality to them. There is something they share. And then Avraham says, Halo chol ha'aretz lefanecha, is not the whole land before you? Hi pared nai ma'alai im ha'smol ve'amina ve'im hayamin ve'hasma'ila. If you go, and what's really interesting, by the way, and JPS have the excellent translation, I was reading more about it, I won't bore you with the details. If you literally translated like, right, if you go left, I'll go right, and if you go right, I'll go left. But JPS translated it as north-south, because that's actually what it means. Now's not the time to talk about this, but in this particular context, it's not, it's north-south directions as opposed to like left-right directions. What Avraham is doing here, though, is essentially fragmenting the tribe and allowing Lot to take his share early. He gets to take his investment early. Avraham is entitled to take all of this land. He knows God told him to do it. And so he says to Lot, look, we can't be together anymore. So you go off, you do your own thing. You get to do it. And and I'll go the opposite direction. I'm not going to get in your way. And we read in verse 10, Vayisa Lot et Einav, Vayaret kol kikar hayardin. Lot looks about and sees, you know, the entire area of the Jordan. Ki chulah mashke. It's entirely watered. Lifnei shichid Adonai tzdom ve'et amora. We get a little, you know, this was before it was destroyed. Remember. Which, by the way, is a fascinating example of how the Torah expects its reader to be omniscient. It knows someone reading this story knows Sodom was destroyed. So it has that little caveat. Oh, by the way, this was, Sodom used to be glorious, just FYI, because it knows if a reader hears the word Sodom, their first thought's going to be, wait, wasn't that destroyed? You already know that happens. So we are told it used to be beautiful. Kagan Adonai Ke'eretz Mitzrayim Bo'achatzah. It's similar to Egypt. It's glorious. It's like the garden of Hashem. Vayivchar Lot et kol kikar hayaden. They separate. That's where Lot goes. That's what he chooses. He chooses the easy life. He chooses the cushy life. And this is not a critique. This is not a bad thing. This is not a poor reflection on Lot. But this is the point. This is why I think they're so frustrated about the wandering. They don't like the famine. They don't like the, you know, the difficulty of travel. They just want to settle somewhere and they take somewhere nice. They take somewhere glorious. And we read, and I think this is really an interesting verse. Verse 12, I bolded it. And let me scroll down the English so the English matches with the Hebrew. Avraham yashav be'eretz Kanaan. Avraham remained in Kanaan. Velot yashav ba'arei hakikar. While Lot settled in the cities of the plain. I think this is really interesting language. I'm cautious of over-assigning too much emphasis to it, but I'm going to do it anyway. Until verse 10, I would have assumed the Kikar HaYarden, the Jordan kind of valley, was part of the land of Canaan. It's all part of Abraham's inheritance. That's what allows Lot to take it. And yet then we read Abraham remained in Canaan, and Lot went to the Kikar, the cities of the plain. In other words, what I'm trying to read into this is the automatic acknowledgement Lot has now taken his lot. Sorry, didn't intend to say that. Lot has now taken his portion, his chelek, in the land of Canaan. So much so it's no longer even called by the Torah Eretz Canaan. It's no longer the land promised to Avraham. Avraham has the rest of it, and Lot gets the Kikar Hayardi. What's really interesting about this is that I would argue this is the example of Avraham. He takes the initiative. He gives to his son Lot his chelek, his portion of the land of Israel. Lot already gets to inherit it. Lot gets to call it his. Avraham gives Lot, his son, a section of the land to be his, basically forever. This is Lot. Lot cashes in. Avraham lets Lot cash in on his inheritance, but it's essentially Avraham trying to settle this dispute. Avraham realizes, look, I'll go off and do my own thing. I'll do keep following my God, but you, Lot is his son. He gets to go. He gets to take his chelek. And the proof, by the way, you'll see I put a little A next to Hakikar. The proof that Lot gets to keep this land is in Sefer Devarim. The second parak of Sefer Devarim, we read the following source number A. Moshe is telling the people, Vayoyma Adonai Eli, God said to me, that's Moshe, El Tatzard Moav, don't harass Moav. Va'al Titka Bam Milchama, don't go to war with them. Ki lo etein lacha me'arto yusha. It's not part of you, the Jewish people's inheritance. Ki livnei Lot natati et ar yusha. It's to the children of Lot, Moav. And then verse 19, v'karavta mul b'nei Ammon. And you're going to be close to Ammon as you enter the land of Israel. Al tutsureim ve'al tutgamam. Again, don't fight them. Don't antagonize them. Ki lo etein me'aretz b'nei Ammon lacha yusha. You don't get to live there. Ki livnei Lot natatiha yerusha. That's for the children of Lot. Lot's two children, really his grandchildren, Ammon and Moab, they are the descendants of Lot, no longer the land of Israel, no longer the chelek of the Jewish people. That goes in all senses of the term, Avraham's decision. Avraham's decision to fragment his tribe has ramifications regarding the legal status of the land of Israel. This moment that we just read, where Lot and Abraham part, splits the land of Israel. It cordons off a certain part of the land of Israel for to ever be for the descendants of Lot, the son of Abraham. In a very real way, Lot is the son of Abraham because he gets to inherit land. And this is as good a time as any to talk about something that I'm also going to talk about next week, but I'll talk about it now. There's a really important distinction when learning the story of Abraham to make between Birkat Abraham, the bracha, the blessing received by Abraham, and Brit, the covenant of Abraham. The bracha, the blessing, wealth, success, and most importantly, land, is received by all his children, all his descendants. Brit Abraham, the covenant, the religion, Judaism, that's only Yitzchak. That's only through the line of Yitzchak, Yaakov, and then the 12 tribes. And this is why any descendant of Abraham gets to keep their land. This is why we are told you can't invade Ammon and Moab because they are legal descendants of Abraham because it was given to Lot, because Abraham gave it to Lot, with Lot essentially acting as his son at the time. Lot gets to keep that land. We also learn Har Seir, the mountain that Esav will inherit. Again, the Torah tells us you can't take that. That's Esav's. Birkat Abraham, the blessing of Abraham, is inherited by all his children. Also Yishmael. Yishmael is actually even stronger. I'll just point this out. I probably won't talk about it next week when we talk about Yishmael, or I'll repeat it and it's cool to hear twice. Yishmael and Yitzchak both have 12 tribes emerge from them. And when we'll read, I think it's a couple of weeks from now, we'll read kind of the descendants of Yishmael. I forget it. Yeah, it's. I think it's at the end of Chayei Sarah. We'll read the descendants of Yishmael. You'll notice there'll be 12 of them, just like the 12 Shvatim. The parallels between Yitzchak and Yishmael are far closer than anything else. But this is the important point to note for now. Lot is the son of Abraham. In all non-biological senses of the word, he's the successor. He's the successor to the tribe of Abraham. And that's why he gets land. That's why he parts, they split, they divide the tribe, and that land forever belongs to Lot, the first son, quote unquote, of Abraham, and not anyone else. This is an example of Abraham taking the initiative to stave off a problem. We've seen it before. We saw it last week. Here we go again. One other, by the way, side point, but I just want to draw your attention to it, still in verse 12. We'll come across it in a second, so I'll point it out then. Verse 13 just tells us that people in Sodom are terrible. It's preempting what we will read in this coming week's parasha. And then we read verse 14. V'Adonai Amar El Avram Achari Parid Lot Me'imor. After Abraham's done this, who appears? Who appears back on the story? Oh, God. God appears. Usually, if you've noticed a thread at this point, God's appearance is usually, Abraham, you've gone done something wrong. Abraham, God basically steps in only when really, really necessary. What does God tell him? Sana inacha or air, look everywhere. Mina makom asher ata sham, tzavon avanegma v'kedma v'yama, look everywhere. Ki et kol ha'aretz asher ata roe lecha et nena ulezaracha ad olam. I give you everything you see. It's like the Lion King moment. You know, look, Simba, everything the sunlight touches. Everything you see, Abraham, will be to you and your offspring forever. V'samti et zaracha ka'afar ha'aretz, and your offspring is the dust of the earth. And then he commands Abraham to kind of walk around. What's really interesting here is basically God tells him, no, what you just did, no, that Lot was not your kid. Lot actually still gets to keep the land, which is really interesting. God acknowledges Abraham's passing on some land to Lot. But God basically turns around and says to Abraham, no, that's not actually what you just did, is not what you thought you did. This whole land is going to be yours. Is going to be to your descendants, in other words. And he reminds him once again, V'samti et zaracha ka'afaretz. You'll have your actual own zera, your own offspring. You'll have your own children. Not Lot, your legal child, your adopted child, but you're actually going to have biological children. and they are the ones who are going to inherit this land. And then we read verse 18, Vayahel Avram, Vayavov, Vayeshev, Beloni, Mamrei, Asher b'Chevron. Avraham pitched his tent, he moves it, he moves to Elon Moreh, Eloni Mamrei, which is Chevron, and he builds an altar. Vayivin Sham Mizbeach L'Adonai. Whenever Avraham builds an altar, that's a key indication of God has just spoken to me, or he wants to speak to God. In this case, it's appreciation. It's realization that what just happened was okay. God's taking control again. God is back. He's here to deal with all the things that need to be dealt with. Just one interesting thing to note. If you actually, you know, when Avraham said, "Oh, I'll go in the opposite direction to you," if you actually looked on a map, and if I had fancier source sheets, I'd show you a map at this point, but I didn't. If you looked at a map and you looked at where Avraham pitches his tent and where Lot is, he's overlooking Sodom. This is going to be important in this week's parasha. Actually, we're going to read how Avraham is overlooking Sodom. Avraham lives within 2 minutes of Lot's house. He actually still remains a protective parent. The very next parak, which we're not going to read, is him saving Lot from a war. Even though Avraham says, "You know what, Lot, we're going to split. Don't worry, you can do your own thing." He actually stays very close and stays hovering by, finds excuses to probably just pop around to check in. But it's actually very interesting. Again, now is not the time to talk anymore about Avraham and Lot's relationship, but it's very parental. That Avraham stays near Lot and then saves Lot from a battle seems to indicate a far more, again, father-son relationship than we might, typically think from our cursory read of the parasha. So that's Lot. That's Lot as successor to Avraham, which in some ways works and some ways doesn't. He is Avraham's successor. He gets land, but clearly, and again, remember, forget you're the omniscient reader. Forget that you know what's going to happen. The fact that God just appeared to tell Avraham, you're going to have your own offspring who will inherit the land, that indicates something else is going to happen. Chapter 14, which I didn't put on the source sheet, is the battle. It's really fascinating. I have a lot to say about Malki Tzedek, but I'm not going to talk about it now because it's not relevant to the top what I want to share with you. So another time we'll talk about Malki Tzedek. And now I want to draw your attention to Perek 15. Achar hadvarim ha'ela. So I put it as source number 2. So first of all, sometime later. So there's been a passage of time, and this is important to realize. I mentioned this last week. We get a series of vignettes with the Avraham story. It's not once he's 75, we learn what he's doing at every single moment of his life. No, we get a series of stories from his life. So what's very important is chapter 15 is intentionally, kind of screen fades to black. And then as the new scene reappears, we get Acha HaDvarim HaEla, which is the biblical equivalent of, 10 years later, 2 years later, 6 months later, as we're used to in movies. Okay, so I want to read, you'll notice there's ellipses, but I just want to read Perek 15 as I've presented it here. Acha HaDvarim HaEla, Haya Dvar Adonai El Avram, God appeared to Avraham B'machazele, more in a vision, and he said, Al Tira Avram, don't fear, Anochi Magen Lach, I'm going to be your shield, Scharcha Harbe Me'od, you will have a tremendous reward, Vayayme Elav, and further he said, Ani Adonai, Eshel Tzeticha Me'or Kastim, Latit Lacha Et Ha'aretz Hazot L'Rishta, I brought you out from Or Kastim, to give you this land as a possession. You'll notice that language is very similar to Eshel Tzeticha Me'eretz Mitzrayim. And then verse 18, Bayom Hahu, on that day, Karat Adonai et Avram Brit Lemor, he made a covenant with Avraham, Lazarachana Tati et Aretz Hazot, to your children, to your offspring. I will give you this land, Minaha Mitzrayim, Adnaha Hagadol, Adnaha Prat, we get the geographical area, and then the people who live currently in that land. Apart from maybe the odd kind of very sharp, abrupt shift, this reads like a very typical kind of biblical story. If we read this right now, and we had, God appears to Abraham, don't fear, I am God, he reminds him who he is, and this is going to be your land, we wouldn't be shocked if just these 5 verses were the entirety of Perek Tetzvav. They would read perfectly like a bit, again, we'd have to maybe, okay, what is this Brit? But broadly speaking, this is a perfectly acceptable, a perfectly fine biblical story. And it's pretty much, again, when we think of the relationship Abraham has with God, this is what we think the relationship is. God appears, boom, I am here for you. I'm awesome. I'm going to give you all this stuff. But the ellipses are important because this perek is punctuated by something fascinating. What actually happens when we look at the entire verse? Acha ha-dvarim ha-ela, God appeared to Abraham and he says, don't fear. I am going to be a shield and your reward will be great. So verse 2. Vayomer Avraham, wait, Avraham cuts him off. He interrupts to say, Adonai Elohim, matitani, what can you give me? Va'anochi holich ariri, I have no children. Uven meshek beiti huda meshek Eliezer, and I'm going to be inherited by my servant Eliezer. Because Lot, you told me Lot failed. I just splintered Lot away, and then you told me he's not going to be my servant. So the second son of Avraham, he makes the briefest of appearances. He doesn't really get anything. Is Eliezer, his servant. He's the only person who's going to inherit him at this point. Now's not the time to talk about like ancient Near Eastern institutions of servants, you know, inheriting. But, you know, furthermore, Vayomer Avraham, Hein li no natata zera. You've not given me any offspring. You tell me, you know, I'm going to get this offspring. You keep telling me this, but where is it? V'hinei ven beiti yorishoti. Eliezer's going to inherit me. My steward's going to inherit me. You give me, in other words, Avraham saying, God, you promised me all these things, but I've got none of them. V'hinei. And therefore, God is actually forced to respond here already. V'hinei devar Adonai elav lemor. The word of God came to him. Lo yurashachaza. No, he's not going to be your heir. Ki imasha yetze mimecha hu yurashacha. No, you're going to have an actual child. He'll inherit you. And then he takes him outside. Verse 5, look towards the heavens. Again, Lion King might as well be the Abraham story. Look towards the heavens. Count them. Count the stars. And then we read, ve'emin ba'adonai v'yachshveha lo tzedakah. And because Avraham put his faith, his trust in God, it reckoned to his merit. So first thing that we actually have here is God appears to Avraham and Avraham cuts him off. No, where are my offspring? And God says, oh no, I'm gonna do it. Don't worry. And we say Avraham is placated. By the way, verse 6 is an incredibly central theological verse for Christians. We kind of just skirt over this verse. We don't put too much emphasis on this. I think I mentioned last week, I must have mentioned last week, maybe I didn't, that for all that we talk about, we are all the descendants of Avraham, the Avraham we draw our attention to, the Avraham we focus on, the Avraham we look to as an example, is actually a very different Avraham depending on, you know, your religion. And then we read, again, we already saw, Vayomer, verse number 7, I am the God who brought you out from Or Kasdim. Lotet lecha et ha'aretz hazot lerishta. I am going to give you this land to inherit. But wait, Avraham interrupts again. Vayomer, he responded, Adonai Elohim bama eda ki arishana. How will I know? Amazing. This is not the Avraham we think of. This is the Avraham who's understandably at his wit's end. He has been told to go to this land. He's gone there. He's got very few indications by God. Malki Tzedek, I think, is important, but we don't need to talk about him right now for Avraham understanding more about God, because Malki Tzedek's also a priest of God, which is, again, something to talk about another time. But basically, Avraham's been told all these promises by God. It's not necessarily clear even to Avraham at this point that God is HaKadosh Baruch Hu. It sounds crazy for us to think this, but you know, it's not implausible that Avraham thinks a God has contacted him, but who knows, you know? Avraham, we put a lot of store in Avraham being the first monotheist. It's not clear al pi pshat at which point in the story that truly takes place. Avraham might still put all the Midrashim aside. I know they're very dear to us and they're very important to us, but put all the Midrashim aside for a second. It's not inconceivable, even if Avraham is following God alone, that he still accepts the notion of a pantheon at this point. He doesn't know. He wants proof. He wants bona fide, genuine proof that God can do the things he can claim to do. Because the truth is, and it sounds almost heretical to say, but this is the pshat we read. All God has really turned up to do at this point is tell him all the things he's done wrong. Okay, he's bailed him out of Egypt. That was miraculous, for sure. But otherwise, he basically just turns up to tell him he goofed. And most of the things Avraham does until now have been on his own initiative. So when Avraham is promised children, Avraham's like, okay, you keep saying that, but I don't have kids. And then when Avraham's promised land, Avraham's like, okay, but like, I don't. The only land Avraham has right now that's genuinely his is Lot's. That's basically the only land that's been officially kind of, you know, conquered, flag drawn in the sand. And even, you know, it's unclear how much control Lot has over Sodom. We don't really get any indication one way or another. Though the end of the Sodom salt story, Lot definitely has a city to his own name. And then we read what are some of the most mysterious and confusing verses in the Torah. But we can actually unpack them a bit. Oh, one other thing to add as I look down at my notes. What also frustrates Avraham is the war that just took place. Now is not the time to talk about the war between the five kings and the four kings. Just trust me on this, it's a war of conquest. And that's the goal. We'll talk about this again another time when we talk about that Perek in a totally different context. So having seen kind of yes, Avraham won the battle, but he's seen the military might available in this land. That further raises questions about his ability to kind of take hold of this land. He's seen there's a lot of military people around. There's a lot of very strong people. Can Avraham really just kind of conquer the whole land? Is it really going to be his? So God turns to him, verse 9. Vayomer elav, kecha li, I'm going to roll it down a bit. I know there's always a bit of a delay with me rolling and people being able to see it. Verse number 9. Kecha li egla mishuleshet, a three-year-old ram, ve'ez mishuleshet, three-year-old goat, a three-year-old ram, ve'ayil mishulash v'tor v'gozal, a three-year-old heifer, a three-year-old goat, a three-year-old ram, a turtle dove, and a young bird. That I got it on the third try. Bring me all these things. We're about to do a ritual. Verse number 10. Vayikach lo et kol eila, Avraham did all of it. He cut them in two. Vayiten ish bitra lekrat ve'ehu, puts them opposite each other. Ve'et hatzipor lo vata, but he doesn't cut up the bird. What happens next? It gets stranger. Vayered ha'ayit al hapgarim. Birds of prey came down upon these now animals that have been cut off. Vayashev otam Avram, and God swats them away. Let's pause. Avraham just engaged in a ritual. So I don't want to describe the details to any degree, but this is not actually an uncommon ancient Near Eastern ritual. And it's actually a ritual of possession. Symbolically, what Avraham has done is put some animals down on the land that is to be his. Birds of prey have come to try and swoop down on the land. And what's Avraham done? Batted them away. He's kept control of his land. It's a symbolic ritual gesture to indicate that Avraham is taking possession of the land. He ritually possesses it from those who seek to conquer it. The birds of prey swarming down on the food are those people who wish to conquer the land of the land away from Avraham, and Avraham's swatting and shooing them away is his symbolic, you know, pushing them away, repelling them. He ritually gets the land. Next. Verse 12. Vayhi Hashemesh Lavo, the sun was about to set. V'tardema nafla al Avram, a deep sleep. Tardema, by the way, also occurs in Parashat Bereshit when Adam falls asleep to have Chava, you know, carved out of him. So we're talking like anesthesiologist levels of sleep here. It's a true, like, boom, he's out. V'hine ema chashecha gedola nofelet alav, a great dark dread descended upon him. And then we read something crazy. It's something that's so crazy you're not going to realize it's crazy, and I'm going to point out to you, and then we'll have heightened everyone's expectations too much, and then it won't be as impressive. But Vayomer Avram, God turns to Avram. Avram's sleeping at this point. Well, Avram's in dread. He's having a nightmare. He's having this deep sleep. No, your people, your descendants will be a, you know, strangers in a foreign land. They will suffer 400 years. But I will execute judgment on the nation they serve. And then they will leave with tremendous possessions. But for you, Avram, verse 15, you will die in peace. You'll be buried kind of, you know, very at peace, very satiated. The fourth generation will return here. For the iniquity of the Amorites is not yet complete. What we just read is something very different than everything until now. We've read lots of conversations with Abraham. God has with Abraham. We don't assume at any point Abraham's asleep, and they tend to be very kind of standard common conversations. I mean, it's God, so how common can a conversation God says is, but it's like, this is very different. This is a prophecy. Abraham gets something very different at this point from God. He falls asleep into a trance. It comes upon him in dread, and God basically tells him the future. And this, I'd argue, is a turning point for the relationship between God and Avraham. After Avraham has expressed his doubts, essentially about God's ability to give him what he says, God has shown really how legit he is. I'm not some common desert deity. I can prophesy. He makes Avraham, you know, also in a sense a prophet. He makes him a disciple, but also, and this is something else I think is interesting, God actually kind of gives Abraham the truth at this point. Until now, God's been very, you'll have descendants, it'll be great, everyone, there'll be so many of them, it'll be wonderful. At this point, God levels with Abraham. They're going to be slaves. They're going to suffer. You'll be fine. You'll be great. But for 400 years, they are going to suffer. And so this is, again, a turning point where God and Abraham change fundamentally their relationship. It's no longer random desert deity talking to random tribal chief, but God prophesying the future to his disciple. Vayihi Hashemesh Ba'a, verse 17, the sun had set, va'alatahaya, v'hine tano ashan v'lapid esh, a smoking oven, a flaming torch, Asher Ava Ben Hagzar Ha'ila, that passes between these pieces. Avraham has a vision of a flame passing over the land, the pieces Avraham just made. So, by the way, what is the symbol of God? If we don't do this because we're Jews and we're very against this. If you had to symbolize God, what symbol would you choose? You'd probably choose a flaming tree, because of the burning bush. By the way, the menorah, which looks like a tree that's always on fire, might be the closest thing to some sort of, you know, physical representation of the symbol of God. God appears in fire. Fire is something that often evokes the image of God. What Avraham is witnessing is God not taking on physical form, because we're all too Maimonidean to accept that. But he's getting some vision of God, fire representing him, kind of moving through those pieces. And then we read, Bayom Hahu Karat Hashem et Avram Berit Lemor. That's when he made the covenant. So what we go through here is this major change in Avraham's story. From this point on, and by the way, we are still in mid Parashat Lech Lecha. Noam White was not done with his Bar Mitzvah Parasha after reading this story. We're maybe a third of the way through the Avraham story, and yet this is the turning point. Until now, what we read was an Avram kind of wandering around, aimlessly waiting for God to speak to him, taking the initiative and failing somewhat miserably. God always having to bail him out. Eventually, he appoints Lot as his successor. Turns out that's not the right thing, even though Lot does inherit because Lot is the son of Abraham in every legal sense. Lot is not going to be the Zera, the offspring of Abraham, the true offspring. And so what follows next is Abraham's frustration at its peak and God resorting to a complete change in his relationship with Abraham. He ceases to communicate with him, however he's been communicating in the past. And he actually does, after Abraham kind of fights back, you know, pushes back, complains, is frustrated about everything Abraham is promising him, he actually gives Abraham a genuine prophecy. Abraham goes into a legitimate trance and has a vision, a more complete vision about what will happen to his descendants. And this is the changing moment in Abraham's relationship, because with God, and also with Abraham's future. Because from this point on, after first trying it with Lot and failing, and again, achar hadvarim ha'ela, for however long we don't know, accepting that the only person who would be his descendant would be his servant Eliezer, he finally changes tack. He now knows he is going to have his own offspring. We all know what's coming next. Abraham is going to have his own child. The major question is going to be, he has two of them. And so what we are going to explore in our final week next week is kind of a very different pace to what we've talked about the last 2 weeks. But we're going to explore the Yishmael-Yitzchak tension as it plays out among everyone, you know, who it plays out with, and that will hopefully yield, again, really interesting, you know, Peshat readings of Parashiyot that by the time we read it, by the time we learn together, we will have read. So we'll have to wait a whole year and really till Rosh Hashanah the following year to truly appreciate. But that's all good.